anyone have HDMI to USB-C converter? HDMI to USB-C.
I think that there is a converter somewhere
around. Yeah. 5 minutes ago.
Okay, I thought you were going to say 5 to 30
minutes. No, maximum. We will have or we will lose between 5 and 6, 7, 8 questions.
For different things?
No, you can choose.
No,
we have, or I have a list of questions, of approximately 50 questions. And out of these 50 questions, there will be 6, 7, 8 questions in the answer. So basically, you can give me a number 13, I look up in the list, and it is related to spectral versus trichromatic color reproduction process. Then, you provide the answer. We won't comment whether this is right or wrong. We will listen and we will make our notes. Then perhaps there is another question, or there will be a follow-up question. So we did that a couple of years. So
based on our discussion, it is not like this question.
No. This year it will be finished for the exam. So then it must be finished. So then you provide the answer, and if you are happy with the answer, then there's the next question. And that is, as I said, very random from what is cultures, what is cultural sensitivity function, we're talking about collaboration. You can expect a kind of question about why do we not detect colors at night, or does the colors appear at night, and you can elaborate on that. So basically, what is collaboration?
It doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, so...
Because if there was a cable layer,
it's supposed to be here.
It's impossible to get it down, so it should be here.
Okay.
But I don't see... Yeah, because you needed to get it to work.
No, and
there
won't be a question.
Sorry,
I don't think
we have. Okay. Then maybe he will have some solution.
Maybe?
As I said yesterday, it's an introduction, of course. But still, I expect that you have a clue about the metabolism, pros and cons.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Hello.
Hi. We are looking for HDMI to USB-C converter, but we have not managed to find it. He's from IT. Yes.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I tried to bring someone here, but
okay. Do you have a? This is PC.
USB-C. Yes. Yeah. HDMI.
The question now is, do you have this?
Let me see. Maybe it should work.
Oh, it's there. Okay. So normally I'm using that one.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure whether this is talking.
Yeah.
That works.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, that works. Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't work. Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it should be somewhere here, but...
But normally IIT is providing this type of adapter, so is this the responsibility of each lecturer? Because in some other rooms, there are plenty of these adapters attached. But not in here.
So I don't know if we're supposed to have them, but I can ask my boss, because he has more control over the rooms than I have.
But because I'm noticing things like that?
Yeah, that's a good starting point.
It's a good starting point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, Ahmed, welcome.
Thank you.
Back to your week.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have not met the first goal of students.
No.
You're teaching the third
semesters. Third semesters, yeah.
So, but perhaps you can just give us a short introduction. What you're doing in a daily
Thank you for the invitation. I'm Ahmed. I'm a research scientist at Syntec Digital. My main work involves more on 3D kind of data, point cloud, mesh, or any other kind of data, plus video image. Most of my work involves working with customers from industry. So a lot of industrial problems. Some of them are research oriented as well. I'm also partly employed at NTNU. So with that part, we are giving this deep learning for visual computing, 3rd semester course. So this is more a crash course for some of you who are interested in deep learning so that you could be productive and you know what you are doing. So how many of you use deep learning in some form in your project? Any project?
Well, I have some of, I guess.
Yeah, that's what my question is, yeah. So, how many of you have used any kind of deep learning in your project? Yeah. So most of you have used some sort of deep learning. So I want to get some a holistic view, one, in terms of how to manage your experiments. Second, understanding the basics. It's surprising like how the basics get lost and you end up with very complicated problem for a very simple problem. Or you use super big network since there are so many things to tune. So I would like to give into a brief understanding of what each component of convolutional neural networks, multilayer perceptrons are. Then I will try to finalize with some application areas overall. So that is a brief agenda of the presentation. But before that, I want to define some specific terminologies. So what's artificial intelligence from your perspective? Because this word has been used everywhere and here and there. So I want to have the same vocabulary. So what's artificial intelligence? Good one. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. You see a lot of people saying we do AI, but somewhere it's just random for us. Yeah. What's artificial intelligence?
We're trying to replicate human intelligence in computers.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So, in general, artificial intelligence is you try to mimic what human, also the smart or AI intelligent system in computers. Yeah. So the next question is, if this is AI, what is machine learning?
It's some sort of like learning process to make the system able to decide on which act that the system should decide in the end. For example, like you have like given this data, this knowledge, and what the system should do, and that's like the machine learning approach that they how they try to train the brain of the system of the AI. So I see that machine learning is part of the AI.
It's part of an AI.
Yes,
that's true. And you also mentioned the predictive part of it, like to predict something. Yeah, you have the
it's the process. Achieve that.
So there are different ways of achieving that. So in machine learning, what you try to aim at is you try to learn most of this abstraction from the data without writing if-else rules. So in old machine learning, not old, but in symbolic AI, people have this logic where if this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens.
It's a knowledge base.
It's a knowledge base kind of approach. Do we call that AI or machine learning? But machine learning is more on the side of the data. Yeah? So then if we narrow down this, what is deep learning? Yes, exactly. So there are, in machine learning, you have a bunch of these algorithms like random forest, SVMs, and all those things. Then in deep learning, the focus will be on artificial neural networks. So basically try to learn this successive abstraction in terms of layers. So that's the part of deep learning. And also it's about learning the representation, meaningful representation. So what I mean by that is, in old times, not old, like a few years back, what you do is you extract features from your image, like for example, whole features or any kind of histogram features. Then you feed that to SVM or any kind of classifier. But now what you try to do is you try to learn the representation without this feature extraction. So you want to have this end-to-end feature extraction representation learning that is suitable for your application. So just to give you some fundamentals, usually the idea of moving away from if-else statements is you want to learn from observation, because humans learn from observation. By doing, by failing. That's how humans learn. So in machine learning, a lot of times people say like, just steal this data, you have this bunch of data, and you hopefully some way you get some meaning out of it. So yeah, some also say it, that machine learning is, or current deep model is statistics on steroids. Statistics have been there forever, but now you just put this frame on it and you just call it machine learning. So it's just about playing with the data. But what do we mean by the data? What's the data? So when I say the data, it's kind of any kind of tensor. So here in this lecture, when I mention about data, it could be 1D tensor, it could be a vector, it could be a matrix, or it could be any kind of D kind of. So in image, at least, you will be working mostly with 2D tensor. In point cloud, 3D. And also you have functional MRI kind of data, where you have 3D volume for each time. Then you have 5D. It could be any kind of data. So just to narrow down how the presentation is organized. So we looked at some of the vocabularies so that we have some common understanding what the data is. So I also want to highlight where this lecture will be focusing on. So we can basically see three kind of learning, supervised, unsupervised, and reinforcement learning. So in supervised learning, you have a given set of input and expected output. So you try to learn a function, a neural network, that tries to map this input space into your output space. So you have one-to-one mapping, input and output. So in unsupervised learning, you don't have any kind of label on the data, so what you have is just the raw data itself without any kind of label assigned to it. So it could be any scatter plots, scatters of points. For example, in point cloud, you have this LiDAR scans, scan. It's just, of course, human can say this is a chair, but you don't know the meaning of it. So if you just plot the whole thing, then you end up understanding more about the data, and then you end up finding some patterns and clusters about the data. So that's more unsupervised. You don't have any labels. So the reinforcement learning is more you learn by doing things. So you have a reward function that penalizes when you do wrong movement or wrong activity or action. So generally, these are the three main categories of learning, but there could be others as well. But overall, in textbooks, these are the main, the ones that are defined. But for this course, or for this brief crash course, what I'll be focusing on will be on supervised learning. Just to give some slide credits, so some of the slides are from Naila, Intro to Deep Learning, even this price from such websites. Yeah, so a brief introduction. I will go through artificial neural networks, fully connected, backprops, comms, and some applications. So some another vocabularies I would like to define furthermore. So when you talk about neural networks, there are few things that need to be well understood. One is activation function, the weights, cost function, and learning algorithms. If you name these four things, you can deploy a successful model. So having a good understanding of what each does is very important. So before let's go in detail from input to the output and see how things come together. So a perceptron is nothing but just, a perceptron is nothing but you have an input, where is my cursor? Yeah, here. So you have an input x1 to xm. So you have this weight, and you have a summation. Just some of this W1, X1, W2, X2. Then you apply some sort of nonlinearity, then you get your output. Yeah? So that is a simple perceptron model. So if you look at the equation on the right, so you could represent the same representation in terms of an equation. So the equation becomes nothing but just you have G, which is nonlinearity, and then you have a bias, W0, you have that, thank you. I was just doing like this, like a Matrix movie. So you have some sort of nonlinearity, and you have a bias, and this is the linear combination of such a hub. So what's the advantage of bias, having bias here? There's going to be a lot of questions faster. Why do you need a bias? So here we have a linear equation. Yeah, this is a linear equation. So if you have a linear equation, what the bias did, what adding a scalar, what does the function? Just move it up and down. Yeah. So if you don't have that, your model will just stuck there, and if data is somewhere else, it will never work. So you need to shift up and down. Clearly. Then you have this nonlinearity function. Yeah? I'll come to the nonlinearity function a bit more, but a typical nonlinear function is, for example, a sigmoid function. Yeah. So there are multiple ways of representing this. So this is an analytic solution. You can also write it in a vector form. So we're going to be using the vector form much more. So in a vector form, you have the bold, just to make sure that it's a vector representation. You have your input and you have the weights, and you have one bias. So your bias for one neuron is one. You don't have multiple paths. Then you pass through some sort of sigmoid function. Yeah? So if you are using PyTorch, you come across multiple activation functions. One is, for example, sigmoid. If you just want to use it, you can just use torch and then sigmoid. Then you use it automatically. Tanage, relu, selu, ilu. There are a bunch of activation functions. So why do we need them? Why do we need? That's exactly what it is. So if you have, as we mentioned, it's just a linear function. So if you have a linear function, you're not, either it could go up and down, it could go side to side, but you never fit. So what if you want to have such kind of complicated boundary, you need to introduce some sort of nonlinearity. So that's where these activation functions comes in. Just to give you a bit more, let me give you an example. You have a weight, 3 minus 2, and the bias is 1. So if you look at this, and if you just substitute, what you have is 1 plus 3 is 1 minus 3 is 2. This is a linear function, yeah? With a linear function, you can't fit the bendy boundaries that you saw. So what we do, we add this sort of nonlinearity, this relu, selu, sigmoid, so that you could go through the boundaries super smooth. Yeah, so, a single layer neural network is, then you have, now we understand, hopefully, from applied perspective, because the detail of this course is more in the second semester, so I just take it briefly. So you have this x1 to xn, and you have your hidden outputs, and you have this nonlinearities, then you have your prediction. Yeah? And this is your final output. So at the hidden layer, you also have an intermediate output, and this is your final output. So your final output is a function of your intermediate output. So you have this cascaded or increasing complexity. So what do you mean by deep neural network then? Yes. Exactly. So if you have multiple of this, that's called deep neural network. I haven't seen a paper that says to call it a deep, 3 is enough or 4 in it. I haven't seen someone claiming that, so it just says more than 2. So that's called a deep neural network. So a fully connected neural network is, for example, it could be like this, and you have multiples of these hidden layers, and you have your output. Yeah. So this is a fully connected layer. So given from what we discussed now, at least in theory, you should be able to implement this. At least the forward pass. Like, it's because it's just a multiplication. Multiplication, some nonlinearity, output summation. So, then the question comes in. Okay. Of course, it is easy to go from input to the output. But since your weights are here, for example, we start with random weights. You see your prediction, and what you want is different from the prediction of the neighbor. So how to quantify this? So basically that's how a loss function is generally measure the deviation between your desired output to the prediction. So it's just a measure. Anything that measures the behavior. So you have your predicted. As you see, your prediction is a function of the weight of the network. So here, W, what does it contain? The biases and all the weights for all the layers. Okay, for all the layers, if you have multiple layers. And you have your current input and you have your current actual ground truth or your desired value. So then you want to measure the difference between the two. So if you have a probability, how do you measure the deviation between two things? Mean square error will work, but if you have a probability distribution, is there any other way of measuring two distributions to be the same, come together? You could use KL divergence, for example, because it's a probability. Once your network output, you know it's a probability, you could use KL divergence. What other thing could you use?
Binary
cross entropy. So there are multiple ways of using it. You could come up with your own function as well. So just to define the terminology so that you guys are up to speed, this is, in some papers, people call it objective function. Sometimes they also call it cost function. Sometimes also call it risk function. So here, N is what? Your all the samples in your data set. Okay? All the samples in your data set, you sum it, you average, you see what's your loss. So, to get you up to speed, here, if you are using PyTorch, this is already done for you. So this is your model prediction. And this is your ground truth. And if you call this function binary cross entropy, it will give you the loss. Or it quantifies the difference between your desired and what the network predicts. Okay? So look at this equation. What's happening here? So yi is your estimate. What the network estimate, yi hat is what the network estimate. Yi is your ground truth. So what happens here? Can someone explain this? Dissipation. This is general binary cross entropy loss. Can someone explain this? What do you see here? For example, let's say your desired value, yi, for that prediction, is zero. This part will be zero, because your ground truth is zero. Then 1 minus 0 is, so you are log 1 minus yi. What if your probability is, your ground truth is 1? This part becomes 0, and you only have this part. So it's kind of trying to measure the information, the mutual information between the two. So if you say 1, it's giving you log of that prediction. If you say no, the other part. So it's kind of competing. It will be interesting for the details of this. Yeah, that's another course, but it is interesting how the loss works. And just to emphasize, make sure that if you are predicting a probability, for example, it could be you are doing a subjective experiment and you want to model the person, the probability of a person picking that image. Then make sure you use the correct loss, because the loss is very important in quantifying what you are trying to measure. The other loss is the one you mentioned, mean opinion score, or mean square error loss, or MSE. So usually this is, if it is continuous values, continuous probability, then you use it, you already know this. But here, I just give it a torch function. If you are using PyTorch, it's very simple, torch and then MSE loss, that you'll get those. Yeah? So now you quantify the loss, that's good. But your model is still wrong. Yeah? So quantifying is one thing, but your model is still predicting the wrong one. So what you do? You need to optimize this loss function somehow. So if you look at a lot of papers, the way they formulate their loss function is like this. So you try to estimate the most optimal weight parameters for your model, such that find the limits such that this argument, this empirical risk or objective function, is minimized. Okay? Note that the W is a parameter, this loss is only dependent on the parameters of the model. So you are, the input doesn't matter. You already quantified the difference. So it's a function of JW. So a loss is a function of the parameters of that model, not the input. So how to do this? Yeah, so just before we continue, remember that these are all the weights, the biases from each layer and all the things. So how to do that? How do you optimize a function in 1D or in a scalar valued function? Find the gradient, yeah, and set it to zero and go, or do something else, yeah? Like, for example, you have a function of a single variable, f of x. So if you want to find the minimum of the function, at least if it is differentiable, it should be differentiable. Yeah, one thing you also need to know that this, if your loss, the way you defined, is not differentiable, you can't optimize it. So it should be differentiable. If you have, for example, your loss is like, if x is 1, gives this value. If x is 2, gives this value. That will not work. You have to come up with a smart way of defining your loss so that it is differentiable. Yeah, so, yes, so what you do, you try to find the gradient. Yeah? So, if you want to optimize a function, like let's say, for example, as I mentioned, j, your loss function, is a function of the weights. Like, for in this case, let's take simple neural network with two weights, W0 and W1. And if you just plot the loss, it's kind of some surface, let's say. As you can see, the surface is smooth. That means it's differentiable, it's continuous. Yeah. So first step is what you do. You want to go slowly. You want to go here. You want to go here. So the first step is you pick a random point in the space in your loss function. Pick a random point. That means initialize W0 and W1. Okay? Then you compute your gradient. Take the derivative. So there is a difference between gradient. So So I will not go in detail how differentiations and all those things for different dimension of the error works, but partial of compute the loss, compute the gradient of your network, and then take a small step each time. In which direction? What is the direction of a gradient? Is it in the increasing direction or in the decreasing direction? Maths 101. First year mathematics, if you compute your gradient, which direction it points to? A gradient is a vector. Yeah? So where it points to? If it's a vector, it should point somewhere. To the weight is increasing. Yes, exactly. Then if you want to go to the minima, you have to go to the opposite side. Yes, exactly. So you try to go small steps until it converges. Hopefully you end up somewhere here. Of course, there is also other places. I'm just lying here. But in truth, sometimes you end up here as well, not here. So I will come to that a bit later on. Yeah, okay. So a typical algorithm that is used in for optimization of neural networks is gradient descent. So in gradient descent algorithm, we do exactly what you just described. You initialize the weights randomly from normal distribution typically. Then you loop until convergence, you compute your gradient of your loss. Then you go from previous steps, from your previous W, you go some eta, small step, in the opposite direction, this minus, and you keep updating until your loss is converged, or until your loss is minimal. So that's how you optimize. So here in PyTorch, it's super easy. So what you do, you initialize your weights. You don't have to compute your gradient, because PyTorch will do numeric differentiation, symbolic differentiation. Then you initialize your weights, then you set your optimizer, you reset your optimizer, then you go one step, you compute your gradient, then you do back propagation. Then, if you repeat this step, hopefully your model will converge. Yeah. So this is gradient descent 101. Just to go detail about the optimization process a bit more, because in earlier courses, maybe you have seen differentiating f of x equals some combination of parameters. But now what we have is you have one layer, and another layer, and another layer, and another layer. So how do you do backpropagation through here? Because it's not like one all dependent in one parameter. So what I mean by that is here you have your loss computed, but you have W2 here, W1 here. How are you going to update W1 given an error on the loss here? So in another word, what you want to find is the contribution of the loss, how much it depends with W2 and W1. You try to find that. So what kind of mathematical trick can you use for this? To go back through composition functions. It's a chain rule. So in chain rule, you have f of g of x, for example, like combinatorial functions. Then you can compose any kind of functions, and you could do backprop through it. So in this case, for example, you are trying to take partial of the loss with respect to the weight 2, and then weight 2 depends on this, depends on y hat, and y hat depends on W2. So you take the partial derivative with respect to each. So in this case, for example, with partial of with W1, you go from the loss with respect to y. Y depends on W1? No, it doesn't depend on W1 directly. So what we need to do, we need to expand this. So we use the earlier, the one we already computed. We expand partial of y hat with z1 and partial of z1 with w1. And we do this for all weights in the matrix. So as you have seen in most of modern deep learning libraries, this is super slow if you do for every weight. What do you think they did? Of course, matrix multiplication. They are matrix. All of them are matrix. Even this is a matrix multiplication. But what did they do? That's a good one. Yeah, there was one author. I don't know if you guys used ResNet network before. And the author, at that time, he used 121 layers, the maximum, at that time. And one of the question was, why you didn't add more layers? Then reason was, I don't have any more GPU. So yeah, have more GPU. Oh, yeah, it could work. But what else? If you look at earlier, here, for example, when we compute with the partial of the loss with W2, we already computed this part and this part. Yeah? Hopefully we can reuse this part. Yeah? Because when we compute for W1 as well, we are computing similar thing again. So they reuse, like you don't have to compute everything one by one. So you need to come up with a way. You could use whatever pre-computed earlier into your current computation. So it's a kind of dynamic programming approach, if you guys are familiar with it. So there are a lot of optimization on this so that everything goes smooth and fast. Yeah, so there is a paper actually that tried to visualize how your loss curve looks like. And this is a paper from 2017, and the paper is titled Visualizing the Loss of neuron nodes. And when you look at it, it looks like Norway somehow. Hills and valleys, and it's beautiful. But it's easy to eat up a lot of local minima somewhere. So coming up with a strategy so that your network doesn't stuck somewhere is very good. So I'll try to highlight some of the things today. But before that, I want to give you another idea on this parameter. So we said small steps. Yeah. So these small steps, also called eta, is a learning rate. What's the effect of learning rate? So What's the impact of learning rate?
How far your brain goes into each step, like the bigger learning rate, like the farther the network moves.
So
it's going to be faster, but it can travel forward. If it's really,
yes.
And if it's too small, it can be so slow.
Yeah. So that's exactly true. So what can you do about it? Then I will skip the next two slides. What can you do about it? Manual experiment? Yeah, try a lot of different learning rates and find one. What else? Some sort of bisection, kind of. Yeah, is it? Yeah, it could work. Yeah. What else can you do? So sometimes you want to adapt how fast you want to go based on how steep your hill is. For example, if it's too steep, you could go probably a bit faster. Maybe if it is going slowly, then I'm not skier, but some people said it's similar to skiing. Like when it's too hill, just if you do want to try to control your fall, so just let it go. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't ski, but people say it's similar to skiing. How to optimize these things? Yeah. So that's maybe, yeah. So, or you could do, you could depend on how large your gradient is, depending on your gradient, or the size of the weights, because you're going to update your weight. If your weights are exploding, I think you need to go slowly, because your weights are too high already. So, in PyTorch, as I say, there is already a lot of things that are implemented for it. So the SGD is noise robust. It is robust for noise. AdaGrad, AdaDelta, Adam, RMS Pro, each have their own benefits with respect to the loss landscape and how noisy your data is. So I have another question for you. Then there is a question of batch size. Why people use batch size greater than one? Like, you normally specify your batch. It's faster, that's true. Why not?
To avoid overfitting.
Maybe not, but yeah, okay. That's a good point. How do you avoid overfitting with batch size? Just I'm not putting you on the spot. Just throw your ideas. Yeah. Some strong point there, but it may be more like let me explain through this slide. Hopefully, so normal SGD, like you start with a single data point, compute the loss with that data point, and you update your weights. That is the one we saw earlier. Yeah. So, what we want to do is we want to pick some batch size. B point, okay? Then we take the average of the loss. So let's say, for example, someone labeled your data wrong, your data is noisy, like one of the labels are wrong. If you do backpropagation on each, you are backpropagating the noise. And your model is like going here and there. So if you use a single batch size, your loss curve will be super noisy. Because some data points are leading the network there, and some there, so it will be super nice. So a typical advice for you is if you could get in your GPU, use at least multiples of 2, but above 8, 16. But at some point, it will saturate, and it will go down, the benefit will go down, because you also want to have some randomness in your optimization. Okay, so I took so much time on this. Okay.
Is there a .NET break?
Yeah.
Does that suit your
yes.
Structure?
Yeah. Probably I'll not finish the lecture, but yeah. Yeah. Let's have 5 minutes break.
Very good.
Yes. Let's do that then. Yes. Think about it during the break, these questions. We talked about it a bit briefly, but number of epochs, we didn't talk about it. what is an epoch in when you train your network? What's an epoch? What's one epoch? What one is an update on the weight, yeah? What's one epoch? Or my pronunciation is bad. Yeah, that thing. Yeah, so once you show the network once, all data, that's called one epoch. So how that impacts your training? Like for example, if you use 1,000 epochs versus 10 epochs. Huh? Yeah, of course. Yeah, it takes more time. That's true. So
as you were to stop. When to stop?
Yeah. What's the impact of that? How do you say?
How much do you feed the
brain?
The more people, the more people
yeah. What's that exception? You can't overfit. What's that exception? There is also another effect that is that could happen called groking. It's a new phenomenon. Actually, it came out in 2019. So what happens is sometimes even if when you train your network even much more than overfitting, early on your network understands, learns the data, then it starts generalizing better. So it is very tricky parameter to pick because learning could happen beyond point of overfitting. So it is an important parameter to look into when you design. So how to stop? When to stop, like for example, you set it 14,000, when do you stop? How? What is the strategy to stop? So the one you just described is kind of early stopping criteria where you try to look at the loss and you have you need to define the patient's parameter. So you wait for some time and then you stop the training. So there are different strategies on how to when to stop when you train. So the reason I'm going in detail on practice is more of a practical class. So you guys, when you train your model, having some practical understanding of what's happening is very important. Because as, I have seen people reporting a result within one single data, the network performs 100% because it was really bad design. And someone could look at the code and like, this is wrong. So yeah, try to analyze each parameter that you said, not just download the code and run, but also understand what's happening behind the scene. So with that, I will try to go to convolutional neural networks. Yeah? So what's a convolution? What's a convolution? Moving a kernel over an image. That's more of like programming understanding. Yes. So what does it mean? What's the physical meaning of convolution? Looking at the local feature image. What is the physical meaning of a convolution? Another. Exactly. You measure if you guys came from signal processing background. You come from
kind of
yeah, exactly. That's usually those people who come from electrical or kind of those signal processing pipeline, they understand convolution in signal perspective. So what you try to learn is you try to measure the presence of a signal using another signal. It's a measure. So I would give you an example what I mean by that. So in a signal processing for 1D signal, that's how you define convolution. You have your kernel, and you have your input signal. Then you shift your input. Yeah. So, yeah, and also it's symmetric. Convolving I with K, K with I, then you do the same. Yeah. So if you look at this, here, you have your input here, and your kernel or K function is this one. So what you do first is this is inverted. So you just flip this, flip, and then you move over the signal. And then you sum along that, you take the integral along each line. And as you can see, I convolves K, K convolves I, that is same. Yeah? So, what is a correlation? Because cross correlation and convolution, they kind of look similar. Yes, correlation finds similarity, or it's a kind of dot product, or it's a it's kind of dot product correlation in itself. But if you look at how the definition, this versus this. So if you look at how the, for 1D case, how they look like, cross correlation is not symmetric as compared to convolution. So the physical meaning, cross-correlation is it measures the presence of the signal in shifted KIJ. Convolution, you try to see the response of your input for a given signal. So it's about, one is about response. You just have a kernel and you try to see how this input respond. Correlation measures, do I find something similar? Have you seen, for example, you can do object detection very easily with correlation. You have your object you are interested in, and you do correlation over the whole image. And it's basically what you are doing is trying to find the presence of this object in your input. That's correlation. Convolution is you try to measure how a system responds to a given filter. Yeah? So that's the physical meaning of the convolution. Yeah, so in most ML libraries, just to, as an interesting fact, in most ML libraries, convolutions are implemented as cross correlations. Why? Because commutative is not important, and if you don't do flipping, you avoid one operation. So most of ML libraries implement without flipping the signal. So let's see some discrete convolution. You have your kernel K and your input image. So the first one is just take you move your kernel over here and you multiply. And I think most of you knows this, or we can go in detail. If you don't understand, let me know, because that's the whole idea of this lecture. Okay, so what you do, you have your input and you have your kernel. So you put this kernel here and you multiply like 0 by 1, 0 by 0, 1 by 0, 0 by 0, and then you sum. That's your response. Yeah? So then you get the first response. You can also think of it as a sliding window operation. So you have your kernel, your input, then you get the first one, like that, the second one, you multiply, you sum, you multiply, you sum, you multiply, you sum. Then this is called, usually called feature So in image, for example, in gray, it could look like this. If it is an image, you get some sort of color-coded feature map. Just a question here for you. Something is wrong. Is there anything wrong here? So basically your input is 5x5, your output is 3x3. Keep shrinking. So a typical, what can you do about it? You can't do padding or something like that. So when you do padding, you start your input like that. Then you get the first value, you move through padding. Then you cut out the signal that you are interested in. Then you get your result. But question on padding. When is zero padding a good idea? How many kind of padding do you know? First, like for example, you could replicate. You have a boundary, you can duplicate, you can zero pad. What else? You can use the mean of the regions. So what's the impact of padding, especially your input? I have come across people who did padding on the input in a way that reflects the class label. So when you train your network, the network didn't learn the data that you are interested in, but it just learned the padding. So you need to be sure, like when you apply some padding, you know exactly where it's happening so that the network doesn't learn what you are not desiring. So I will, if you want the details, there are other materials that to look into the impact of padding on your training. And so convolutional neural networks are just nothing but neural networks with convolutions, simply saying. So what are the main advantage? So we have seen earlier fully connected neural network where every input is connected to everything, at least to the next layer. Why we need another layer, so another kind of operator called convolutions? Why not do everything with NLP? So,
simplifications for images and translations have this is better for images because it's allowing the encounters like dimensions, but also like that's
invariancy. You have some point, there is some structural information that is already there. I will give you four reasons why you might consider NNs as compared to MNPs. So these are sparse connectivity, parameter sharing, translation invariance. I will come to it one by one. So let's say you have an input like this. This is a multilayer perceptron. You have five inputs. You have hidden. You have your bias. That's your output. So you get your first hidden layer, the second one, the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one. That's normal MLP. Yeah? Everything is connected to everything. So if you have convolution, you have one filter that moves. You are shifting. You move. So basically, with operation, how many parameters do you have to learn here? Five by five parameters. Here, how many parameters do you have to learn? How many parameters you have to learn here? Here you learn, you need to learn three only, because you are using the same three all the way. In fully connected, you have to use, you have to learn 5x5. So that means dense connectivity versus sparsity. This is sparse. So for how many multiplications do you have to do here? Here, 5x3, huh? So you also save number of multiplications you have to do. One, you reduce the number of parameters you learn. Second, you reduce the number of multiplications you have to do. So, like for example, simple example. What if you have 25 inputs? How many parameters do you have to learn? Here? Three again. So, because you're going to use the same. Yeah? So, the scaling effect and the number of multiplication will be 25x3. So, the other advantage is translation equivariance. What is translation equivariance? So, if your input shifts, like for example, you, in your training data, a cat is located at the corner, and you want to detect the cat when it is below. So that means, irrespective of the location, you want to be able to detect that object. So that is, your output is equally varying with the location, doesn't depend. So you want to have that property somehow embedded. So if you shift your input here, by x1 becomes x2, x3, like this. So, and your current output is h2, h3, h4. Then basically, it's what we are doing is we are trying to shift the input. So, yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, this is a butterfly. So I have to be a bit faster. So you want to be able to detect even here it's a butterfly. You wanna say the network says this is still a butterfly. Yeah. And the other thing is, so if you have another input here, x6, how are you going to handle in multilayer perceptron? How do you handle? So you have a multilayer perceptron, and initially you are using 5 variables. And the customer comes to you and says, there is another one button. So what can you do? Retrain. You have to retrain. Because you can't do anything more. Because there is no wait for W6. But in CNNs, what you do? You use the existing filter. Yeah, it just moves. That's cool. So it supports arbitrary input size. So that's some of the advantage of CNN. So I hope I go through some of these pointers. You share parameters, the three. The sparse connectivity is not easily connected. Translation equivalence, arbitrary input size. These are some of the advantages of CNNs as compared to MNPs. So when to consider CNN, image data, when to consider MLP, example, tabular data. If you do convolution on tabular data, I don't know what you are learning. You are learning something, sometimes I see people who get 100% efficiency accuracy, but you have no idea what it's doing. So not everything is solved with the same hammer. So effect of stride. So one of the parameters when you define a comp block with PyTorch is you need to specify a stride. So a stride is the distance between two consecutive positions of the kernel. So if you have, for example, your first kernel like this, you get your first output. Then a stride by one, one by one, is basically shipped one by one. You don't skip. So with stride 2x2, what you do is you shift by two. So what is the advantage of this? Why you want to do this? I'm going to ask you a lot of why questions today. The main objective is so that you guys know, when you do neural networks, you know what every operation means. Why? Yeah, but other options are there. Why is try to? It reduces redundancy. If you look at, if you have an image of super high resolution, the neighboring pixels should not be the same. They will not contain a lot of information for you. So then, in that case, having stride greater than one makes sense. But if you have very, if you want to keep details of things, if you want to use higher stride, then the impact would be negative. And you can also compress the feature map. Okay, pooling. Pooling operation is usually to summarize a given set of input. So it's a summary layer, it summarizes your input. So in pooling layer, typically you have max pooling, average pooling, or a mix of the two. So let's take max pooling. So max pooling is you just take the max of your pooling size. So you take the max of this 3, the max of this 3, the max of this 3. So if you for example, if you shift your input by one, what happens? Only one of the outputs changes, the others remain. So in other words, pooling layers will help you keep shift invariance. Even if there is some shift, you'll be able to say the same thing, able to predict the same thing. So if you shift the whole, for example, this 5x5, only one is changed as compared to the whole output. So you get this shift invariance for free. Why pooling is useful? Reduce dimensions or summarize, yeah. Another. Invariance, yes, exactly. So you get the invariance, and yeah, you able to compress or summarize the signal. Yes. Yeah. So that's a good question. Don't have any completion. link would give you summary operation, especially for example, this max pooling, kind of summarize the whole. Like if you have three outputs that's coming, you get one output for each. So it's just a summary. Or in another word, if you have a feature space, you get the response from the maximum. Like because the others are suppressed, you get the most important. You can bring the samples and sort of thing.
So how does that help us like printing information, like using that information box?
So yeah, yes, but like for example, I have some slides later on to show each layer as you go deeper in the network. The first layers contain some garbage information that may not be relevant for the final classification. For example, you are interested in doing this classification, and some of the lower layers learn about some irrelevant features. Then you want to suppress those features, but you want to keep the most prominent for your classification that your objective is through the network. You want to propagate those important information all the way.
And what if we use a convolution instead of pooling? The convolution that returns a smaller feature, wouldn't that be the same thing? But instead, we also increase the replication power of the network.
Yes, you could do that. But you don't have to have pooling. You can just do convolutions with higher stripes. Yeah, so. Receptive field, the other thing is important things to consider, receptive field. It's a term that is taken from neuroscience. So basically, it's a stimulus region that impacts a given neuron's firing. It's called the receptive field of that neuron. So for example, what the receptive field of, H3, if these three inputs. That means the output of this neuron state is dependent on these three. That is the effective receptive field of this neuron. So if you look at for P2, then the receptive field is H2, H3. So that's the neurons that directly impact. So effective receptive field is the part of the input that is responsible for change in the node. Back to the input, that is the effective receptive field. Effective receptive field depends on your network weight, the gradient flow, and other information. So this is also very important when you try to justify why your network is predicting some value. By the neural networks are very lazy learners. They learn the noise than the data that you're interested in. So the best way to look at what your network is learning is to go back and look at what the network is looking at. Okay? As a good practice, please do that so that you could identify what your network is looking at and learning. So let's say, for example, in this case, you have an input, 3D, 6x6x3, and you have three filters, 3x3x3, what will be the output shape? You do convolution? Nobody. Or? Stride one. Four by four by four. Because when you do convolutions, remember it is doing all the way for the whole thing. Then you take the average. So in summary, if your input is H, your input filter, input signal, and width, and you have channel, you have N filters. So the way you compute your output filter size is you have your input, the HF, the height of your filter, padding, the stride, plus one. Then you could find what is the output shape of your filter. Yeah, so basically, as a neural network, what you have is like this. You have some linearities and all those things. So question for you. I think I better discuss with you after this, because I will not be fully covering. I have other tons of slides on different types of convolutions. Then I was going a bit more but then I will try to summarize it here. So here, in this case, we have 20 filters instead of 2. How many parameters do you need to learn? How many parameters do we need to learn here? So, as I mentioned earlier, this you have 20 of this. So for each block, you have one bias. So you have 3 by 3 by 3, 27. And for that 27 parameters, you have one bias, 28. 28 times 20, 500 something, that's the number of parameters you have. So with that, I will probably discuss with you on maybe if you have some deep learning projects that you are currently working on and you want to discuss, it's better, because it doesn't make sense to start another topic for 10 minutes. Yeah, questions? So it's not a technique, but it's more of kind of 2018 or 2019 was discovered. Sometimes learning happens after overfitting. But you never know. The trick about deep learning is you never know. Yeah, there is one student working on it this semester on that paper. I'm waiting for his report, what he finds. I will ask him this question. Do you understand why it happens? So I'll ask him. But it's more of the paper is more a descriptive paper. It just showed this phenomena happens in at least for simplistic cases. But they haven't shown it for complicated data sets. Maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't happen. But it's an interesting phenomena sometimes. So what happens is your training curve is super hard. That means, and if your test is not improving that much and your training is super high, you kind of know it's overfitted. Then all of a sudden your test there, your test just jumps all the way. And then stabilizes almost close to the training. And there are other phenomena as well, like phase shift. When you train a motor, phase shift is like, why you have a lot of these variations in your... There are tons of things that could go wrong when you train a motor. So, most of you, this project, this course have a project. Literature, okay.
Some of you guys use deep learning.
Yeah.
Remember exactly
the other thing, for example, I hope you guys could explain is CNNs, like for example, at least in Kerala, you are interested in appearance, and sometimes CNNs focus on, depending on the type of network you are using, some of them are tuned for shape than texture itself. So how do you differentiate this? Yeah, exactly. So if you want to learn, for example, for a texture, you can synthetically generate texture all over, but keep the shape, or the vice versa, so that you get the desired response as you want. Yeah, other questions? Well, should I create my own trivia questions? Okay. Yeah, okay. Other questions? How do you keep track of your training? Tensorboard is one. So, what do you log in Tensorboard?
Loss.
Loss for testing. What else can you do? What else, like, what are important to diagnose your network that your network is training? You could also, maybe the weights, the gradient itself. You can log the gradient with TensorFlow. Then you could see if any weight is coming to the input side. Sometimes your network doesn't learn because the backpropagation, the weights, the updates are too small, close to the input. Then when whatever you do, it will never learn. So it's good to also see the gradient there. What other thing do you check? Like, so that's the training part. But most of the time, at least in the industry, I spend most of my time looking at the data. What can you look at? What's important about the data first? What do you check about the data? So someone comes to you. This is hyperspectral images, and I want you to do compression of this data. So what's something to consider in that problem? How many images? So, one is if your data, if the data you have in the training and test, how do you split them? First, you need to be able to objectively split and have three sets and don't cheat. So a lot of time what happens is people look at the validation like this and then, yeah, okay, I can tune this and get some better result there. So please don't do that. That's cheating, basically. That's one. And the second thing is make sure your data is what you want. So what I mean by that is labels are correct, because a lot of times the labels are noisy when it comes from these experiments. The other is to look at how they are similar, like for example, pass through a ResNet or any kind of network, visualize the embedding space, where do they lie, are they similar, are they very different? So is your data representing all the possible input space that you expect? So That is very important parameter to consider. A lot of time what you do is you train in very small space and you try the network somewhere the data I've never seen and end up failing. Actually the main course for this is a semester course where we go details of the mathematics and understand. This is more high level than just gentle introduction to CNNs, but we have more high level detail course for this concept.
I assume you will be probably.
So with that course, we will be now we are aiming to consider also NLP and other applications, not only vision. There we also cover some of the phenomena that I don't even know, but it will be interesting to discuss with the students.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like for example, this groking effect. I have no idea why it happens. So we give it to one student. And he's trying his best.
Okay.
Tak.
Thanks. Excellent. So then we are done for today. I wish you good luck to tomorrow.
staying here. What the hell, guys?
Yeah.
I thought we said this is a good room.
Yeah, because there's no plastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why is the room a good
room? There's stupid crap.
We need to tell him, like, this room is, like, available.
Some people left, so just... Let
yeah, let them know that this room is, like, available, so...
I think that it is. It's free. Who's gonna have a class?
I mean, we have class.
It's us. Hey, you know. I don't like cozy.
Do you like this room?
Yeah, yeah, he's really nice, actually. Nice implementation. It was way better than the other guy.
Useful stuff on the.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a water bottle, there's some food.
Food.
And, yeah, it's a little painful having to talk to people. So like,
yeah.
You know.
Huh? I actually would like some
tea.
A113. What? Where?
A113.
Is it
A113?
Yes. Is it available?
Yeah, yeah, I checked this one. There's
in
a little.
Hello.
I lost.
does this work? No, yes, yeah, we can have a break.